1.3. His cousin Andrew was dead. Shot down in action was how Ferguson's father explained it to him, the action being a night patrol in the frigid mountains that stood between North and South Korea, a single bullet fired by a Chinese communist soldier, his father said, which entered cousin Andrew's heart and killed him at the age of 19. It was 1952, and the 5-year-old Ferguson supposed he should feel as wretched as everyone else in the room. Aunt Millie and Cousin Alice, to begin with, couldn't go longer than 10 minutes without breaking down and crying again. And sad Uncle Lou, who smoked cigarette after cigarette and kept looking down at the floor. But Ferguson couldn't muster the grief he felt was required of him. There was something false and unnatural about trying to be sad when he wasn't. For the fact was that he had never liked Cousin Andrew, who had called him pipsqueak and runt and little shithead, who had bossed him around at family gatherings and had once locked him in a closet to see if he was tough enough to take it. And even when he left Ferguson alone, there were the things he said to his sister Alice, the cutting epithets such as pig face and dog brain and pencil legs, which made Ferguson cringe with disgust. Not to speak of the pleasure Andrew seemed to take in tripping and punching Cousin Jack, who was only 1 year younger than Andrew, but half a head shorter. Even Ferguson's parents admitted that Andrew was a troubled boy, and for as long as Ferguson could remember, he had been overhearing stories about his cousin's antics at school, talking back to the teachers, setting trash cans on fire, breaking windows, flunking classes. So many misdeeds that the principal finally kicked him out in the middle of his junior year. And then, after he was caught stealing a car, the judge offered him a choice, either jail or the army. So Andrew joined the army, and 6 weeks after they shipped him to Korea, he was dead. It would be years before Ferguson understood the full impact of this death on his family, for he was too young at the time to grasp anything but the ultimate effect it had on him, which wasn't made manifest until he was 7 and a half. And therefore, the 2 years between Andrew's funeral and the event that cracked apart their little world passed in a blur of present tense childhood. The mundane affairs of school, sports and games, friendships, television programs, comic books, storybooks, illnesses, scraped knees and banged up limbs, occasional fistfights, moral dilemmas, and countless questions about the nature of reality. And through it all, he continued to love his parents and feel loved by them in return, most of all by his high-spirited, affectionate mother, Rose Ferguson, who owned and operated Roseland Photo on the main street in Millburn, the town where they lived, and to a lesser, more precarious degree by his father, the enigmatic Stanley Ferguson, who said little and often seemed only dimly aware of his son's existence. But Ferguson understood that his father had much on his mind, that running Three Brothers Homeworld was an all-out, round-the-clock job, which necessarily meant he was distracted. But at those rare moments when he wasn't distracted and could focus his eyes on his son, Ferguson felt confident that his father knew who he was, that he hadn't confused him with someone else. In other words, Ferguson lived on safe ground. His material needs were taken care of in a consistent, conscientious manner, a roof over his head, 3 meals a day, freshly laundered clothes, no physical hardships to be endured, no emotional torments to arrest his progress. And in those years between the ages of 5 and a half and 7 and a half, he was developing into what educators would have called a healthy, normal child of above-average intelligence, a fine specimen of mid-century American boyhood. But he was too caught up in the tumult of his own life to pay attention to what was happening outside the circle of his immediate concerns. And because his parents weren't the sort of people who shared their worries with small children, there was no way to prepare himself for the disaster that struck on November 3rd, 1954, which expelled him from his youthful Eden and turned his life into an entirely different life. Among the many things Ferguson knew nothing about prior to that fateful moment were the following. 1. The extent of Lou and Millie's grief over the death of their son, compounded by the fact that they saw themselves as failed parents, having brought up what they considered to be a damaged person, a delinquent child with no conscience or moral foundation, a mocker of rules and authority, who exulted in stirring up havoc wherever he could. A liar, a cheat from start to finish, a bad egg. And Lou and Millie tortured themselves over this failure, wondering if they had been too hard on him or too soft on him, wondering what they could have done differently to prevent him from stealing that car, which proved to be his death sentence, and how torn up they felt for having encouraged him to join the army, which they thought might help straighten him out, but instead had put him in a wooden box 6 feet under the ground. And therefore, they felt responsible for his death as well. Not just his fractious, angry, misspent life, but also his death on that frozen mountaintop in godforsaken Korea. 2. Lou and Millie had a taste for alcohol. They were one of those couples who drank as both a sport and a compulsion. A bibulous, insouciant pair of theatrical charmers whenever they were lubricated within the scope of their capacities, which were substantial. But oddly enough, it was the pin-thin Millie who seemed the steadier of the two, who rarely ever wobbled or slurred, whereas her much larger husband sometimes went overboard. And even before Andrew's death, Ferguson could remember the time when he saw his uncle passed out on the couch and snoring in the middle of a loud family party, which everyone had found so funny when it happened. But now, in the aftermath of that death, Lou's drinking had increased, spreading beyond the parties, the cocktail hours, and the post-dinner nightcaps into high-noon lunchtime sloshes and secret tipples from the flask he carried around in the inside pocket of his jacket, which no doubt helped numb the pain twisting through his guilt-ridden, ravaged heart. But the booze began to affect his work at the store, sometimes rendering him incoherent when he talked to customers about the relative merits of Whirlpool and Maytag washing machines. And when he wasn't incoherent, he was occasionally irritable. And when he was irritable, he often took pleasure in insulting people, which was no way to conduct business at Three Brothers Homeworld. And so Ferguson's father would have to step in, pull Lou away from the offended customer, and tell him to go home and sleep it off. 3. A known fact about Lou was his penchant for gambling. If not for Millie's job as a buyer for Bamberger's department store in downtown Newark, the family would have gone broke many years earlier, since most of what Lou earned at Three Brothers Homeworld tended to wind up in his bookie's pocket. Now, as his drinking burgeoned out of control, so too did his taste for long odds hunches, the dream of the spectacular once-in-a-lifetime killing, the kind of legendary bet gamblers would go on talking about for decades. And the more erratic his guesswork became, the more his losses grew. By August 1954, he was $36,000 in the hole, and Ira Bernstein, the man who had been handling his bets for the past dozen years, was running out of patience. Lou needed cash, no less than $10,000 or $12,000, a hefty lump to prove his good intentions, or else the boys with the baseball bats and the brass knuckles would be coming around to pay him a visit. And because he couldn't ask Stanley for the money, knowing his kid brother had been serious when he'd sworn never to bail him out again, he stole it from Stanley instead. By putting a stop order on a check to Three Brothers' GE supplier and transferring the amount of the check over to himself. He knew he would be found out eventually, but it would take some time for the discrepancy to come to light. Since the flow of cash for goods between the store and its suppliers ran on a system of mutual trust, and the bookkeeping lagged months behind the actual exchanges, and those months would give him the time he needed to put things right again. In late September, Ferguson's uncle saw his chance. It would mean putting a stop order on another check, but if all went well, the embezzled $9,000 would be turned into a haul worth 10 times that amount, which would be more than enough to make good on the 2 stop checks, pay off Bernstein in full, and walk away with a nifty bundle for himself. The World Series was about to begin, with the Indians heavily favored over the Giants. So much a sure thing that betting on Cleveland was hardly worth the effort, but then Lou thought, if the Indians were that powerful a club, what was to stop them from winning 4 in a row? The odds in such a bet were far more enticing. 10-1 for a sweep, whereas putting his money on Cleveland 1 game at a time would yield only pennies. So Lou found himself another bookmaker, that is, someone whose name wasn't Bernstein, and put the $9,200 he had stolen from his brother on the Indians. betting they would run the table without a single loss to the Giants. No one knew where Ferguson's uncle watched the first game, but as Stanley and Arnold and the rest of the staff at Three Brothers Homeworld gathered around the television sets in the store to follow the action with 50 or 60 walk-in customers, who weren't real customers but Giants fans with no televisions of their own, Lou slipped out to watch the game by himself, perhaps in a local bar or some other place, an unknown spot where no one saw him live through the horror of watching Mays run down Wirtz's fly ball in the top of the eighth inning, and then, even more terrible, the soul-crushing devastation that followed some minutes later when he saw Rhodes turn on Lemon's pitch and send the ball into the right field stands. One swing of a man's bat, and another man's life was in ruins. 4. In mid-October, the GE supplier informed Stanley that they had no record of payment for a truckload of freezers, air conditioners, fans, and refrigerators that had been delivered in early August. Mystified, Stanley went to the Three Brothers' bookkeeper, Adele Rosen, a plump widow of 56 who kept a yellow pencil in her hair and believed in the virtues of precise penmanship and rigidly aligned columns. And once Stanley explained the problem to her, Mrs. Rosen pulled out the company checkbook from her desk drawer and found the stub for August 10th. Which verified that payment had been made in full for the amount they owed, $14,237.16. Stanley shrugged. The check must have been lost in the mail, he said. And then he asked Mrs. Rosen to put a stop order on the August check and issue a new one to the GE supplier. The next day, a deeply puzzled Mrs. Rosen reported to Stanley that a stop order had already been put on that check as far back as August 11th. What could that possibly mean? For the briefest of brief instants, Stanley wondered if Mrs. Rosen hadn't betrayed him, if his heretofore steadfast employee, who was widely known to have been secretly in love with him for the past 11 years, wasn't guilty of cooking the books. But then he looked into Mrs. Rosen's troubled, adoring eyes and dismissed the thought as nonsense. He called Arnold into the back office and asked him what he knew about the missing $14,000, but Arnold, who looked no less shocked and confused than Mrs. Rosen had looked when confronted by this same mystery, said he couldn't even begin to imagine what was going on, and Stanley believed him. Then he called in Lou. The oldest member of the clan denied everything at first, but Stanley didn't like the way his brother kept looking past him at the wall behind his shoulder while they were talking. So we pressed on, grilling Lou about the stop order on the August check, insisting that he was the only one who could have done it, the only possible candidate, since Mrs. Rosen was in the clear, as were Arnold and himself, and therefore it had to be Lou. And then Stanley began to bore in on the question of Lou's recent gambling activities, the exact amounts he had wagered, the total extent of his losses, what baseball games, what football games, what boxing matches. And the harder Stanley pushed, the more Lou's body appeared to weaken, as if the two of them were slugging it out in a ring, and each word was another punch, another blow to the gut, to the head. And bit by bit, Lou began to stagger, as if his knees were about to buckle. And suddenly he was sitting in a chair with his face in his hands, sobbing out a chopped-up, barely audible confession. Stanley was appalled by what he heard. For in point of fact, Lou wasn't the least bit sorry about what he had done. And if he was sorry about anything, it was only that his plan hadn't worked. His beautiful, flawless plan. But the Indians had let him down and lost the first game of the series. And fuck Willie Mays, he said. Fuck Dusty Rhodes. And Stanley finally understood that his brother was beyond hope. That for a full-grown man to point his finger at a couple of ballplayers and think they were the cause of his troubles meant his mind was no more developed than a child's, an idiot child at that, somewhat as impoverished and handicapped as Lou's own son, the dead and buried Private Andrew Ferguson. Stanley was tempted to tell his brother to leave the store and never come back, but he couldn't do that. It would have been too sudden, too harsh. And as he pondered what to say next, knowing he couldn't say anything until his anger had subsided somewhat, at least down to a level that wouldn't make him regret his words, Lou began to talk again. But what he was telling Stanley was that they were all up to their necks in it, and that the store was finished. Ferguson's father had no idea what Lou was talking about, so he held his tongue a bit longer, beginning to feel that perhaps his brother had actually lost his mind. And then Lou was talking about Bernstein and how much money he owed him. More than 25,000 now, but that was only the tip of the iceberg, for Bernstein had begun charging interest. And every day the amount was going up, 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 and in the past 2 weeks there had been half a dozen phone calls, a voice on the other end of the line threatening him to pay what he owed or else suffer the consequences, which variously meant that a team of men would jump him in the dark and break every bone in his body, or else blind him with acid, or else cut up Millie's face, or else kidnap Alice, or else kill both Millie and Alice. And he was scared, Lou told his brother, so scared that he couldn't sleep anymore. And how was he going to raise the cash when his house was carrying two mortgages and he had already borrowed $23,000 from the store? Now Stanley's knees were beginning to buckle as well. He felt disoriented and dizzy, no longer quite himself, no longer fully encased in his own skin. And so he sat down in a chair on the other side of the desk from Lou, wondering how $14,000 had suddenly turned into $23,000. And as the two brothers looked at each other across the surface of the gray metal desk, Lou told Stanley that Bernstein had come up with a proposal. And as far as he was concerned, it was the only way out of it, the only possible solution. And whether Stanley liked it or not, it had to be done. "What are you talking about?" Stanley said, speaking for the first time in the past 7 minutes. "They're going to burn down the store for us," Lou said. "And once we collect on the insurance, everyone takes a cut." Stanley said nothing. He said nothing because he had to say nothing, because the only thought in his head at that moment was how much he wanted to kill his brother. And if he ever dared to speak those words out loud, to tell Lou how much he wanted to put his hands around his throat and strangle him to death, his mother would curse him from her grave and go on torturing him for the rest of his life. At long last, Stanley rose from the chair and began walking toward the door. And once he had opened the door, he paused on the threshold and said, "I don't believe you." Then he left the room, and with his back to his brother, he heard Lou say, "Believe me, Stanley, it has to be done." 5. Stanley's first impulse was to talk to Rose, to unburden himself to his wife, and ask for her help in stopping Lou. But again and again he struggled to get the words out of his mouth, and again he failed, each time backing down at the last minute because he couldn't bear the thought of listening to what she would say to him, what he knew she would say to him. He couldn't go to the police. No crime had been committed yet. And what sort of man accuses his brother of plotting a potential crime when he has no hard evidence to substantiate proof of a conspiracy? On the other hand, even if Bernstein and his brother eventually went through with it, would he have it in him to go to the police and have his brother arrested? Lou was in danger. They were threatening to blind him, to kill his wife and daughter. And if Stanley stepped forward now, he would be responsible for that maiming, for those deaths, which meant that he was a part of it too, an unwilling co-conspirator in spite of himself. And if things went wrong and Bernstein and Lou were caught, he had no doubt that his brother wouldn't hesitate to name him as an accomplice. Yes, he despised Lou. He was sickened by the mere thought of him. And yet, how deeply he despised himself for feeling that hatred, which was sinful and grotesque and only further increased his inability to act. For by failing to talk to Rose, he understood that he had chosen the past over the present, had renounced his place as husband and father to go back to the dark world of son and brother, a place where he had no wish to be anymore. But he couldn't escape. He had been sucked back into it, and for the next 2 weeks he walked around in a demented state of dread and fury, walled off from everyone by his unbroken silence, seething with frustration, wondering when the bomb inside his head would finally explode. 6. As he saw it, there was no alternative but to play along, or pretend to play along. He needed to know what Bernstein and company were planning, to be kept abreast of the details, and in order to learn those things he had to trick Lou into believing he was with him. So the next morning, just 24 hours after their last conversation, the chilling dialogue that had ended with the words, "It has to be done," Stanley told Lou that he had changed his mind, that against his better judgment, and with infinite disgust in his heart, he understood there was no other way. This falsehood produced the desired results. Thinking Stanley was now on board, a grateful, trembling, all but unhinged Lou began to treat his brother as his cherished ally and most trusted confidant. And not once did he suspect that Stanley was acting as a double agent whose sole intention was to gum up the works and prevent the fire from happening. 7. There would be two men, Lou informed him, a seasoned arsonist with no criminal record, working in tandem with a lookout, and the date was set for Tuesday, the night of November 2nd/3rd, as long as it turned out to be a dry night with no rain in the forecast. Lou's job was to dismantle the burglar alarm and provide the men with keys to the store. He would spend the night at home and suggested Stanley do the same. But Stanley had other plans for that night, or just a single plan, which was to park himself in the unlit store and chase off the firebug before he could start his work. Stanley wanted to know if the men would be carrying guns, but Lou wasn't certain. Bernstein had neglected to touch on that point with him. But what difference did it make, he asked. Why worry about something that didn't concern them? Because someone might choose the wrong moment to go walking past the store, Stanley said. A cop, a man out with his dog, a woman on her way home from a party. And he didn't want anyone to get hurt. Burning down a business for $300,000 in insurance money was bad enough. But if some innocent bystander happened to be shot and killed in the process, they could go to jail for the rest of their lives. Lou hadn't thought of that. Maybe he should bring it up with Bernstein, he said. But Stanley told him not to bother, since Bernstein's men were going to do exactly as they pleased, regardless of what Lou wanted. That put an end to the discussion. And as Stanley walked away from his brother and entered the downstairs showroom, he realized that this question of guns or no guns was the great unknown variable, the one factor that could destroy his plan. It would make sense for him to buy a gun before Tuesday, he told himself. But something in him balked at the idea, a lifetime of revulsion toward guns, so much so that he had never fired one or even held one in his hand. His father had been killed by a gun, and what good had it done him to be carrying his own revolver in that Chicago warehouse 31 years ago? He had been shot down anyway, killed with an unfired .38 in his right hand. And who knew if he hadn't been killed because he'd gone for his gun first, leaving his killer no choice but to shoot him in order to save his own life. No, guns were a complicated business, and once you pointed a weapon at someone, especially someone with a weapon of his own, the thing you were counting on to protect you was just as likely to turn you into a corpse. Besides, the man Bernstein had dug up to incinerate Three Brothers' homeworld wasn't a contract killer, but an arsonist. An ex-firefighter, according to Lou. That was a good one. A man who once made his living putting out fires, now setting them for fun and profit. And why would he need a gun to do that? The lookout was another matter, no doubt some broad-chested thug who had come to the store fully armed, but Stanley figured he would be waiting outside while the ex-fireman went about his job, and since Stanley would already be inside before the two of them showed up, he concluded that a gun wouldn't be necessary. That didn't mean he would go there empty-handed, but a baseball bat would serve his purpose just as well, he felt. A 36-inch Louisville slugger would scare off the torch just as effectively as a .32-caliber pistol. And given Stanley's state of mind in the 2 weeks leading up to November 2nd, the demonic, half-mad, out-of-control roar of thoughts that had been raging in his head since the morning of Lou's confession, he found the idea of a baseball bat deeply and perversely funny, so funny that he laughed out loud when the idea came to him. A brief yelp of a laugh that rose up from the bottom of his lungs and burst out of him like a splatter of buckshot bouncing off a wall. For the whole gruesome comedy had started with a baseball bat, the bat used by Dusty Rhodes at the Polo Grounds on September 29th, and what better way to end the farce than by taking hold of another bat and threatening to bash in the head of the man who wanted to burn down his store. 8. On the afternoon of the 2nd, Stanley called Rose to tell her he wouldn't be coming home for dinner that evening. He would be working late with Adele, he said, going over the books in preparation for an audit that was scheduled for Friday. and chances were it would keep them busy until around midnight. So Rose shouldn't bother to wait up for him. The store closed at 5 on Tuesdays, and by 5:30 everyone but Stanley was gone. Arnold, Mrs. Rosen, Ed and Phil, Charlie Sykes, Bob Dawkins, and the absent Lou, who had been too frightened to come to work that morning and had spent the day at home with a pretend fever. Bernstein's men wouldn't be turning up until 1 or 2 in the morning, and with several blank hours in front of him, Stanley decided to go out to dinner, indulging himself with a visit to his favorite Newark restaurant, Moishe's, which specialized in Eastern European Jewish cuisine, the same food Stanley's mother had cooked for him in the old days. Boiled beef with horseradish, potato pierogen, gefilte fish, and matzo ball soup, the peasant delicacies of another time, another world, and Stanley had only to walk into the dining room at Moishe's to be thrown back into his vanished childhood, for the restaurant itself was a throwback, a threadbare, inelegant place with cheap, plastic laminated tablecloths and dusty light fixtures hanging from the ceiling. But each table was adorned with a blue-tinted or green-tinted seltzer bottle, a sight that for some reason never failed to provoke a small surge of happiness in him. And when he heard the grouchy, ill-mannered waiters talking in their Yiddish-inflected voices, that brought comfort to him as well, although he would have been hard-pressed to explain why. So Stanley dined on the dishes of his youth that night, starting with borscht and a dollop of sour cream, followed by a plate of pickled herring, and then on to a main course of flank steak, well done, with cucumbers and potato pancakes on the side. And as he squirted jets of seltzer water into his clear, ribbed glass and worked his way through the meal, he thought about his dead parents and his two impossible brothers who had caused him so much heartache over the years, and also about his beautiful Rose, the person he loved most, but not well enough, never well enough, a fact he had understood for some time now, and it pained him to admit there was something blocked and stifled about him, a flaw in his makeup that prevented him from giving her as much of himself as she deserved. And then there was the little boy, Archie, a pure conundrum, that one. No doubt a lively, quick-thinking fellow, a boy above most other boys, but he had been his mother's child from the start, so attached to her that Stanley had never managed to find a way in. And after 7.5 years, he was still flummoxed by his inability to read what the boy was thinking, whereas Rose always seemed to know, as if by some inborn knowledge, some inexplicable power that burned in women but was rarely granted to men. It was unusual for Stanley to dwell on such matters, to drive his thoughts into himself and seek out his failings and sorrows, the torn threads of his patched-together life, but this was not a usual moment for him. And after 2 long weeks of silence and inner struggle, he was exhausted, barely capable of standing up anymore. And even when he could stand up, too unsteady to walk in a straight line. And once he had paid for his dinner and was driving back to Three Brothers' homeworld, he wondered if his plan made any sense at all, if he hadn't deluded himself into thinking it would work simply because he was right and Lou and the others were wrong. And if that was the case, perhaps he should just drive on home and let the store burn to the ground. 9. He returned to the store a few minutes past 8. All dark, all still. The nightly nothingness of mute televisions and dozing frigidaires, a cemetery of shadows. He had little doubt that he would live to regret what he was doing, that his calculations were bound to go wrong, but he had no other ideas, and it was too late to think of another one now. He had started the business when he was 18, and for the past 22 years it had been his life, his one and only life. And he couldn't let Lou and his band of crooks get away with destroying it, because there was more to this place than just the business. It was a man's life, and that man's life was the store and the man were one, and if they set fire to the store, they would be setting fire to the man as well. A few minutes past 8. How many hours to go? At least 4, perhaps as many as 5 or 6. A long time to sit there doing nothing, waiting in a pitch-black room for a man to show up with his cans of gasoline and his book of killer matches. But there was no choice except to wait there in silence and hope the baseball bat was as strong as it looked. He settled into a chair in the back office, Mrs. Rosen's chair, the one that belonged to the desk in the far corner, which had the best view through the narrow, rectangular window set in the wall between the office and the showroom. And from where he was sitting, he could see all the way to the front entrance, or would have been able to see it if the store hadn't been in total darkness. But the gasoline man would surely be carrying a flashlight in his pocket. And once Stanley heard the front door open, the light would be turned on, even if only for a second or two, and then he would know where the man was. Immediately after that, throw on the overhead lights, burst out of the back room, clutching the bat in his upraised hand, shout at the top of his voice, and order the man out of there. Such was the plan. "Cross your fingers, Stanley," he said to himself, "and if luck isn't with you, then cross your heart and hope to die." Meanwhile, he went on sitting in Mrs. Rosen's chair, which was mounted on wheels and could swivel from side to side and tip back and forth, a standard office chair, comfortable enough to sit in for a little while, but hardly a good spot for the long haul, long being the 4 or 5 hours that were still in front of him, and yet the more uncomfortable the better, Stanley reasoned, since a state of mild discomfort would help to keep him alert. Or so he thought, but as he sat there, behind the gray metal desk, rocking back and forth in Mrs. Rosen's chair, telling himself that this was the worst moment of his life, that he had never felt unhappier or more lonely than he did now, that even if he managed to get through the night in one piece, everything else had been smashed, hammered into dust by Lou's betrayal, and after this night nothing would ever be the same, for now that he was betraying Lou, Bernstein would resort to his old threats, which would put Lou and Millie in danger again, and if anything happened to them, it would be on Stanley's head. He would have to live with it and die with it, and yet how could he not do what he was doing? How could he let himself get caught up in an insurance scam and risk going to jail? No, he couldn't let them burn down the store. They had to be stopped. And as Stanley continued to think about these things, which were the same things he had been thinking about and thinking about for the past 2 weeks, he understood that he couldn't take it anymore, that he had come to the limit of what was possible for him, that he was worn out, weary beyond all measure, so tired that he couldn't bear to be in the world anymore. And little by little his eyes began to close, and before long he had stopped fighting to keep them open and to put his head down on his folded arms, which were lying on the desk in front of him. And 2 or 3 minutes after that he was asleep. 10. He slept through the break-in and the subsequent dousing of the store with 12 gallons of gasoline. And because the man who had come to do the job had no idea that Stanley was sleeping in the back room, he lit the match that ignited Three Brothers' homeworld with a guiltless conscience, knowing he was about to commit an act of arson, but not that he would later be charged with manslaughter as well. As for Ferguson's father, he never had a chance. By the time he opened his eyes, he was no more than half-conscious, unable to move because of the vast clouds of smoke he had already inhaled. And as he struggled to lift his head and breathe some air into his scalded lungs, the fire was burning its way through the door of the back room. And once it had entered the room, it rushed over to the desk where Stanley was sitting and ate him alive. These were the things Ferguson did not know, the things he could not have known during the 2 years that separated his cousin's death in the Korean War from his father's death in the Newark fire. By spring of the following year, his Uncle Lou was in prison, along with the gasoline man Eddie Schultz, his lookout accomplice George Ianello, and the mastermind of the operation, Ira Bernstein. But by then, Ferguson and his mother had left the New Jersey suburbs and were living in New York, occupants of a 3-bedroom apartment on Central Park West between 83rd and 84th Streets. The photography studio on Milburn had been sold, and because his father's life insurance policy had provided his mother with $200,000 tax-free dollars, there were no financial burdens, which meant that even in death, the loyal, pragmatic, ever-responsible Stanley Ferguson was continuing to support them. First, the shock of November 3rd, and with it the spectacle of his mother's tears, the onslaught of intense, smothering embraces. Her gasping, shuddering body pressed against him, and then, some hours later, the arrival of his grandparents from New York, and the day after that the appearance of Aunt Mildred and her husband, Paul Sandler, And through it all, the comings and goings of countless Fergusons, the two weeping aunts, Millie and Joan, the stone-faced Uncle Arnold, and even the treacherous, not-yet-exposed Uncle Lou. So much chaos and noise, a house with too many people in it. And Ferguson sat in a corner and watched, not knowing what to say or think, still too stunned to cry. It was unimaginable that his father should be dead. He had been alive the previous morning, sitting at the breakfast table with a copy of the Newark Star-Ledger in his hands, telling Ferguson it was going to be a cold day and he should remember to wear his scarf to school. And it made no sense that those were the last words his father would ever speak to him. Days passed. He stood in the rain beside his mother as they lowered his father into the ground, and the rabbi intoned a dirge in incomprehensible Hebrew. Such awful-sounding words that Ferguson wanted to cover his ears. And 2 days after that, he returned to school to fat Mrs. Costello in a second-grade class, but everyone seemed afraid of him, too embarrassed to talk to him anymore, as if an X had been stamped on his forehead to warn them not to come near. And even though Mrs. Costello kindly offered to let him skip the group lessons and sit at his desk reading whatever book he wanted, that only made things worse somehow, for he found it difficult to keep his mind on the books, which normally gave him so much pleasure, since his thoughts would invariably drift off from the words on the page to his father. Not the father who was buried in the ground, but the father who had gone to heaven, if there was such a place as heaven. And if his father was indeed there, was it possible that he was looking down on him now, watching him sit at his desk pretending to read? It would be nice to think that, Ferguson said to himself, but at the same time, what good would it do? His father would be glad to see him, yes, which would probably make the fact of being dead a bit less unbearable. But how could it help Ferguson to be seen if he himself couldn't see the person who was looking at him? Most of all, he wanted to hear his father talk. That was what he missed above everything else. And even though his father had been a man of few words, a master in the art of giving short answers to long questions, Ferguson had always liked the sound of his voice, which had been a tuneful, gentle voice. And the thought that he would never hear it again filled him with an immense sadness, a sorrow so deep and so wide that it could have contained the Pacific Ocean, which was the largest ocean in the world. It's going to be a cold day, Archie. Remember to wear your scarf to school. The world wasn't real anymore. Everything in it was a fraudulent copy of what it should have been, and everything that happened in it shouldn't have been happening. For a long time afterward, Ferguson lived under the spell of this illusion, sleepwalking through his days and struggling to fall asleep at night. Sick of a world he had stopped believing in, doubting everything that presented itself to his eyes. Mrs. Costello asked him to pay attention, but he didn't have to listen to her now, since she was only an actress trying to impersonate his teacher. And when his friend, Jeff Balsoni, made the extraordinary, uncalled-for sacrifice of giving Ferguson his Ted Williams baseball card, the rarest card among the hundreds in the Topps collection, Ferguson thanked him for the gift, put the card in his pocket, and then tore it up at home. It was possible to do such things now. Before November 3rd, they would have been inconceivable to him. But an unreal world was much bigger than a real world, and there was more than enough room in it to be yourself and not yourself at the same time. According to what his mother later told him, she hadn't been planning such a quick departure from New Jersey. But then the scandal broke, and suddenly there was no choice but to get out of there. 11 days before Christmas, the Newark police announced that they had cracked the Three Brothers Homeworld case. And by the next morning, the ugly particulars were front-page news in every paper across Essex and Union counties. Fratricide, gambling kingpin arrested, ex-fireman turned firebug held without bail, Lewis Ferguson indicted on multiple charges. His mother kept him home from school that day, and then the day after that, and the day after that, and every day until the school closed for Christmas vacation. "It's for your own good, Archie," she said to him, and because he couldn't have cared less about not going to school, he didn't bother to ask her why. Much later, when he was old enough to grasp the full horror of the word fratricide, He understood she was trying to protect him from the vicious talk circulating around town. For his name was now a notorious name, and to be a Ferguson meant you belonged to a family that was damned. So the soon-to-be 8-year-old Ferguson stayed at home with his grandmother as his mother went about the business of putting the family house on the market and searching for a photographer to buy her studio. And because the newspapers never stopped calling, asking, begging, harassing her to open up and give her side of the story, the latter-day Jacobean drama now known as the Ferguson Affair, his mother decided that enough was enough, and 2 days after Christmas, she packed up some suitcases, loaded them into the trunk of her blue Chevy, and the three of them drove to New York. For the next 2 months, he and his mother lived in his grandparents' apartment on West 58th Street, his mother back in the old bedroom she had once shared with her sister Mildred, and Ferguson camped out in the living room on a fold-up cot. The most interesting part of this temporary arrangement was that he didn't have to go to school, an unexpected liberation caused by their lack of a fixed address, and until they found a place of their own, he would be a free man. Aunt Mildred opposed the idea of no school for him, but Ferguson's mother calmly brushed her off. "Don't worry," she said. "Archie is a bright kid, and a little time off won't hurt him. Once we know where we'll be living, we'll start looking for a school. First things first, Mildred." It was a strange time then, unconnected to anything he had known in the past, utterly separate from the way things would be for him after they moved into their apartment. A curious interregnum, as his grandfather put it, a short span of hollowed-out time in which he spent every waking moment with his mother, the two beaten comrades who trekked up and down the west side looking at apartments together, conferring about the pluses and minuses of each place, mutually deciding that the one on Central Park West would be just about ideal for them. And then his mother's surprising declaration that the house in Millburn was being sold with the furniture, all the furniture, and that they would be starting again from zero, just the two of them. So after they found the apartment, they spent their days shopping for furniture, looking at beds and tables and lamps and rugs, never buying anything unless they both agreed on it. And one afternoon, as they were examining chairs and sofas at Macy's, the bow-tied clerk looked down at Ferguson and said to his mother, "Why isn't this little boy in school?" To which his mother replied, with a hard stare into the nosy man's face, "None of your business." That was the best moment of those strange 2 months, or one of the best moments, unforgettable because of the sudden feeling of happiness that rose up in him when his mother said those words, happier than at any time in weeks, and the sense of solidarity those words implied, the two of them against the world, struggling to put themselves together again, and none of your business was the credo of that double effort, a sign of how much they were depending on each other now. After shopping for furniture, they would go to the movies, escaping the cold winter streets for a couple of hours in the dark, watching whatever happened to be playing just then, always in the balcony because his mother could smoke up there. Chesterfields, one Chesterfield after another, as they sat through movies with Alan Ladd, Marilyn Monroe, Kirk Douglas, Gary Cooper, Grace Kelly, and William Holden. Westerns, musicals, science fiction, it didn't matter what was showing that day. They would walk in blindly and hope for the best from Drumbeat, Vera Cruz, There's No Business Like Show Business, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Bad Day at Black Rock, The Bridges at Toko Ri, and Young at Heart. And once, just before the strange 2 months came to an end, the woman in the glass booth who sold them their tickets asked his mother why the little boy wasn't in school. And his mother answered, "Butt out, lady. Just give me my change."